Washington, D.C. every Wednesday from 3 to 4 p.m. for an hour-long Generation Progress Takeover.
Check us out at genprogress.org or on Twitter at genprogress. The Generation Progress Takeover of the Leslie Marshall Show. I'm your co-host, Charlotte Hancock.
And I'm Brent Cohen.
Today we have a great show for you all. We have a couple of guests calling into the studio. First up, we have Jenny Pizer from Law. She's the Law and Policy Director of the Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund. And we're going to talk with Jenny about the Equality Act and how that might impact the LGBTQ community. Oh my gosh, I feel like Trump when he tried to say that during the during the debates. And next up, we have Rania Copeland. She is the president and CEO of the Black AIDS Institute, and we're going to talk to her a little bit more about how the Black community has been impacted by that crisis and that epidemic. But first off, Jenny, how you doing? We have you there on the line?
Yeah, great. Happy to be with you here in sunny Los Angeles from Lambda Legal's Western office.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Jenny. So, Jenny, I wanted to go ahead and just kind of jump right into this and to give people a little bit of the background that we have on the Equality Act. So the Bipartisan Equality Act was reintroduced in Congress last week, and this crucial piece of legislation would ban discrimination against LGBTQ people in all aspects of life, including housing, employment, public accommodations, credit, education, and jury service. So can you tell us more about what the Equality Act does and why we really need this legislation?
Yeah, happy to. So yeah, it was very exciting last week that this bill was reintroduced. This is the third time it's being introduced in Congress. This time it was introduced with so many co-sponsors in the House that it actually could pass tomorrow. It's not going to be pulled up for vote that quickly, but the support is super strong. Strong support in the Senate as well, and it's bipartisan in both houses. So it's truly exciting, both because it has so much support and because of what's in the bill. So as you said, the bill covers these important areas of life for all of us. It does a series of important things. So first of all, it writes explicitly into federal law protection against sexual orientation or gender identity discrimination, making clear that those types of discrimination are forms of sex discrimination. So it's building on the existing civil rights framework that we've had in this country for 50 years that has included protection against sex discrimination in quite a few areas, employment, housing, credit, health care. Lambda Legal and other groups have been litigating to enforce those protections in a range of areas, and there's been a lot of success. But what we need as a community and as a movement is to have those protections written explicitly in the statute so everybody understands that the protection is there. So including these protections within the existing civil rights framework is very important because it means that 50 years worth of case law and public understanding of what civil rights protections are, how they're supposed to work, that's the framework that protects everybody. We're not making a big change to have different legal standards, and so it should make it clearer and more workable for everybody. But it's not just that. A couple of additional changes are with respect to the protection against discrimination in what we call public accommodations. So this is public services and businesses and hotels, restaurants, transportation. These have been particularly important parts of our civil rights protections for decades. But that existing law does not include protection against sex discrimination. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be added, as well as explicit protections against sexual orientation and gender identity discrimination. But also, the protections in the existing federal law are going to be expanded so that they're in harmony with the protections that we have now in the Americans with Disabilities Act, and to make it much more consistent with what lots of states have. So, for example, to cover retail businesses. I mean, lots of people would think that that law already covers retail businesses, and it doesn't, so that's a limitation of the original law. And transportation services like buses and ride shares and trains, shelters, a lot of things like that. And also very important, especially for members of our communities who are most vulnerable, is that programs supported by public funding must not discriminate against LGBT people or based on sex, so against women or against men. That's a new protection that's going to make a big difference. A couple of other key things. The bill makes explicit that the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which is about protecting religious liberty, that those protections are not a legal defense against the civil rights protections that are in this bill. That's something that we believe is already existing law, but it's important that we make it explicit. So that's part of the bill as well.
So what kinds of, if I could like maybe go to a specific example of something that might be prevented by having the Equality Act in place, is this the sort of thing where like we might not encounter another couple who wouldn't, for example, be able to get a wedding cake from the vendor that they chose? You know, is there something like that in there that we can be thinking through when we think of some of the specific examples here?
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, I think some of the issues that same-sex couples encounter all the time go well beyond wedding cakes and flowers. It's really a matter of businesses, restaurants, hotels. Lambda Legal has had litigation on behalf of a couple that was ejected from a taxi in a rainstorm on a highway because the driver was offended by the fact that it was a same-sex couple. So unfortunately, there's discrimination against same-sex couples and queer individuals, and in particular, sometimes vicious discrimination against folks perceived as trans who are transgender by businesses, by all kinds of services, including government-funded services. So it's about ensuring equal access. And I think a key thing for us to recognize that it's partly the practical protections, the fact that when somebody is harassed or denied services or fired from a job or denied an apartment, that they would have a legal remedy. But the message of equality and deterrence is just as important. I mean, the goal here is for society to recognize that we're all equal. Everybody is entitled to be treated equally by businesses and agencies providing services, so that the equal treatment should happen. It's not just about, like, everybody wants to have an opportunity to sue. Lambda Legal, we litigate. But really the goal is an important message of equality and inclusion, as well as providing people a remedy when they're treated unfairly, and particular things like losing a job, being denied housing, being denied health care, being denied access to a shelter. These are things that lead to poverty, lead to health consequences, I mean, that really cause a lot of the disparities that our communities are experiencing that are, you know, a real problem.
Absolutely. So, Rania, we have just about another minute here before the break. I want to make sure people know where to find you online, because I think some of the points that you're making are so important. It is, as you're saying, not just small things like picking wedding vendors, but really impacts quality of life overall. So I want to make sure that people know how to get in touch with you. Can you give everybody your Twitter handle real fast?
Yeah, well, mine is at Jenny Pizer, with JennyPizer, and folks should follow also Lambda Legal at Lambda Legal is LambdaLegal, and my fabulous colleagues who handle our Twitter world are amazing, and there's enormous good information there, and on, of course, on the Lambda Legal website, which is lambdaleg.org.
Okay, great. So we have just we'll be right back after this break, and we'll talk a little bit more with Jenny about the Equality Act. Thanks so much for listening.
Welcome back to the Generation Progress Takeover of the Leslie Marshall Show. I'm your co-host, Brent Cohen.
And I'm Charlotte Hancock.
Before the break, we were talking with Jenny Pizer, the Law and Policy Director at Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund, about the Equality Act. Thanks for coming back with us.
Hey, glad to be with you.
So I want to go back quickly to one of the something that you mentioned before the break about the concept of religious freedom. Can you share with us a bit more about how both Donald Trump's budget would harm the LGBTQ community and how the administration's using this concept of religious freedom to discriminate against the community?
Yeah, those are really good questions. So a couple things. The budget that Donald Trump has proposed, I mean, let's first take a deep breath and recognize that it's a statement of what that administration thinks is important, but it's not the actual budget that is going to be our national budget. The statement that it's making, though, is really appalling and offensive in a bunch of ways. They propose to slash funding for a range of public health programs that are essential for, you know, a great many Americans, and specifically so for many members of our LGBTQ communities, Medicare, Medicaid, a range of public health programs recognize that health disparities particularly affect folks who are living in poverty, which is disproportionately the case for many of our community members, for folks who are living with HIV or at risk for HIV, healthcare. Proper access to health care is essential, but it's not just a matter of health. For example, another program targeted by this budget is for food supplement, the SNAP program, food stamps. The proposal is to add onerous and ridiculous work requirements for access to food stamps. I mean, the reality is that this here in the wealthiest nation on the planet, we have food insecurity for an appalling number of people, and this is another thing that disproportionately affects our community. And to impose requirements designed to kick people off the food stamps program is really unconscionable. So that's an area of real concern. The helpful backstop being that that's not actually what the budget is going to be moving forward, because folks in the House of Representatives, they actually put the budget together and they don't have those priorities. But on the issue of religious freedom, there are serious harms that are happening given the people that Donald Trump has put in charge of some of the important programs. So, for example, I mean, the issue here is that religious liberty is a core American value. It is already firmly protected by our Constitution and by the constitutions of every state and by a range of laws. But protection from discrimination, against discrimination based on one's religion, is not to be turned into a tool for discriminating against others. And that's the problem we have with this administration. So, for example, the person who is put at the head of the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Health and Human Services, Roger Severino, is somebody who comes out of the religious right movement. He was at the Heritage Foundation. He was very involved in litigating cases designed to expand the ability of people to discriminate based on religious beliefs and to decline to do certain aspects of their job or to otherwise act in ways that would be contrary to the rules. There are regulations that have been proposed to allow people working in health services, whether it's as healthcare providers or doing other jobs, to refuse to do aspects of their job based on religious beliefs of certain kinds. Now, these regulations have not gone into effect yet, I should say, but they've been proposed. Mm-hmm. Lambda Legal and many of our sibling groups in the movement have opposed those proposed changes, and we are prepared to litigate if we see final rules that look anything like what was proposed. But this does get at an existing problem. Even without those rules, there is a widespread and mistaken belief among some healthcare providers that religion gives a license to discriminate. And so we see queer people being refused care that would be provided to anyone else based on the religious beliefs of the provider. And we see these problems in the education sphere as well, and in public accommodations. Lambda Legal has been litigating a case about a lesbian couple, on behalf of a lesbian couple, refused the ability to have a room at a B&B because of the owner's religious objections. You know, these are problems, unfortunately, that crop up in many contexts. And among the most problematic aspect of this administration is the message, whether it's dog whistles or whether it's explicit, that the interests of those who want to act based on religion to the detriment of others, that is encouraged, that is supported. And so, for example, this administration gave permission to South Carolina that they can license religiously based child welfare agencies, this is foster care and adoption agencies, to use federal money in those programs and to discriminate based on religion in providing those services. So this means that children that are in the care and custody of the state for whatever reason, that need to be placed with a home, whether it's a foster home or an adoptive home, won't have the full range of opportunities, the full range of prospective parents, because these federally funded agencies screen prospective parents based on whether they do or don't conform to the particular brand of Christian fundamentalist beliefs.
Wow.
Unfortunately, I could cite many examples of this, but it's across many areas of our society, and it tends to be most burdensome, most harmful to those who are least able to defend themselves. I mean, we litigate to try to limit the harm, but the reality is there are people who are being denied the services they should receive because of religion in ways that is not appropriate and should not be legal.
So, Jenny, we've got about 1 minute left in the segment. I just wanted to ask real quick, is the Equality Act likely to become law, and what are the inflection points that people have if they want to take action on this?
It absolutely is likely to become law. Not this year, because passage means being approved by both houses and then signed by the president. But the very strong support that it has already there's wonderful momentum. Inflection points coming up. There will be a hearing in the House Judiciary Committee within the next couple of weeks. Possibly also in the Education and Labor Committee. So hearings between now and the hearings and after the hearings, folks should be encouraged to send letters, messages to your representatives supporting the act, and then be part of the broader effort.
Thanks, Jenny. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. We'll be right back after this break with a little bit more from Rania Copeland. Whatever it takes.
Generation Progress Takeover of the Leslie Marshall Show. I'm your co-host, Brent Cohen.
And I'm Charlotte Hancock.
Thanks for coming back with us. We are pleased to welcome my good friend, Rania Copeland, the president and CEO of the Black AIDS Institute. Hi, Rania.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation.
So before the break, we were talking with Jenny Pizer of Lambda Legal. About the many ways in which the Trump administration's budget would harm the LGBTQ community. And one of the ways we talked about were the proposed budget cuts to healthcare that would disproportionately impact those living with HIV and AIDS. And so my question for you, Rania, is, you know, HIV and AIDS is not the death sentence it used to be for many HIV-positive Americans, but it's still a destructive force in the LGBTQ community. And Black Americans continue to be disproportionately impacted by both HIV and AIDS. What impact, if any, has the Trump administration had on the fight to end this epidemic in Black communities?
Well, Brent, you know, you're right that HIV continues to be a huge epidemic in Black communities, and particularly amongst Black gay men, though, you know, there's an epidemic amongst Black women and particularly among Black trans women as well. We in the HIV field have been talking about how we have the tools to end HIV for a few years now. So we have these biomedical interventions that show that we could theoretically and through modeling show that we can get to the end of the epidemic. And so we have pre-exposure prophylaxis, so people who are HIV negative can take a pill every day and prevent HIV acquisition. For people who are living with HIV, when they are linked to care, when they stay in care, when they are virally suppressed, there is the benefit that they are able to live long and healthy lives. And so when folks are virally suppressed, they are more likely to die of old age than HIV. And then there's the secondary benefit that when people who are living with HIV achieve viral suppression, so virus, because the virus is so low in their body that you can't actually pick it up on tests, they can't transmit HIV either. And so there's no more new HIV infections. And so we've been talking to the federal government for years now and saying, you know, we can end this epidemic. Let's do this. And so we were surprised when Trump released his plan and strategy to end HIV by 2030, particularly because we know that he has really fueled stigma when it comes to racial rhetoric and really racism and sexism and homophobia and transphobia. And so we were surprised, though happy to hear that somebody's listening and saying, you know, let's kind of take the science up.
So how do we match up? I'm glad you brought up Donald Trump's recent pledge in the last State of the Union to stop the spread of HIV within a decade. But his budget, his 2020 budget, includes sharp cuts to Medicaid, a program that we know 2 in 5 people living with the virus depend on. So how do we reconcile that?
Well, you tell me how to reconcile all of it. I don't think there is any reconciliation, right? So there's this increase for HIV for $291 million, like you said. But then there's a $63 million cut to HOPWA, which is housing opportunities for people who are living with AIDS. Like you talked about, there is the Medicaid cuts, as well as instituting work requirements, which we know is hugely impactful for Black communities, people who are living with HIV. You know, in Arkansas alone in 2018, when they instituted work requirements, that it resulted in the loss of coverage to over 18,000 individuals. And so,
wow.
You know, I think that this exemplifies this strategy, right? So you talk about let's end HIV. You know, you have this strategy that, you know, from what we hear, that he's really saying that he wants this to be his kind of like PEPFAR. And so George Bush implemented the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, which has had a huge impact globally on HIV and provides funding for HIV prevention and care to many countries across the world. So this is kind of this platform that he wants to stand on. But then, you know, there are things like not expanding Medicaid or putting into place, you know, trans discrimination laws in the military. And so that it's really kind of a piecemeal situation. We know that Medicaid expansion is critically important, particularly for states in the South that didn't expand Medicaid and where the majority of the HIV epidemic is. And so, you know, but that what the administration has done is modeled in each of these jurisdictions and states that's within their plan how they can actually get to the end of the epidemic while not expanding Medicaid. And so I think that this disjointed strategy is a concern that many folks in the HIV workforce have. You know, these things go hand in hand. And, you know, we know that, you know, lack of housing fuels the HIV epidemic. We know that poverty fuels the epidemic. And we know that stigma fuels the epidemic. And so, you know, these things can't be siloed out, that it's not going to be just these biomedical interventions. It's not going to just be people taking medications that's going to get us there. These are the hardest hit communities, and the type of support that we have to give, the resources, the policy changes that have to happen really are much larger and, you know, aren't being responded to if not, you know, actively being tried to dismantle.
Yeah, and I mean, I think you were even more generous than I would be by calling it a disjointed strategy. It is a disjointed brain dump of ideas on a piece of paper at times, it feels like, which is unfortunately true in a host of different areas, including this one. So if you had your druthers in a sort of perfect world here, what should the federal government be doing, and what steps can sort of state and local governments that may be in a different political situation or just a different situation altogether be taking right now?
Yeah, so we've been talking to the different people who are the architects of the plan, right? So this includes the Centers for Disease Control, Health and Human Services, NIH. And for some of those folks, they've been huge advocates within the HIV community for a very long time. So, for example, Dr. Tony Fauci has been, you know, an exemplary leader when it comes to HIV and AIDS for, you know, the entirety of his career. And so we've been really talking to them about how they can, because there is this $291 million that's going to be distributed to these 48 jurisdictions in 7 states within this fiscal year 2020 budget, 2019 and 2020 budget. And so we've been asking that there is strong guidance and requirements so that, particularly in states that didn't expand Medicaid, in places like Alabama, where you still aren't allowed to use the word sex in school, that they can provide recommendations, right, and not even just recommendations, but really requirements for how this money is utilized. We're asking for community oversight over how the money is utilized and the planning purposes of it. We have to make sure that communities are not left behind, that this money doesn't go to organizations that don't know how to serve Black people, that don't know how to serve Brown people, that, you know, don't have trans representation within their leadership, that, you know, really that there's accountability and there's also transparency. How are organizations getting funding? What money is state health departments getting? What money is city health departments getting? Where are community health clinics getting money? And making sure that there is transparency and who gets funded, how they get funded, and what they're going to be accountable for are some of the kind of major things that we're asking for. And then also asking for, you know, please look at all of these other policies that we know fuel HIV. How does the president's language and policies that he puts in place really affect people on the ground, folks in Louisiana, people here in Atlanta, in the everyday kind of work of living their lives, are some of the kind of bigger recommendations that we are bringing to the administration and that we're really organizing. It feels in some ways like the early days of the epidemic, you know, when people were acting up and rising up. One of the amazing things around HIV activism is that folks came together to really change the way we did public health. The way the FDA approved medications is completely now based off of advocates saying, you know, you have these medications that you know work while people are dying in the streets. Give us the medications. Or saying, you know, hey, we need money to pay for this disjointed system that you guys have that's called healthcare. And we have the Ryan White Act, which is one of the largest funded single health programs in the country. And so really making sure that as a group of activists, as a group of folks who've been doing HIV work for 30 plus years, that we're holding the administration accountable and saying, you know, yes, we're happy that you listen to the science, but there's not enough. And that, you know, you can't be successful in a disjointed strategy.
So, Rania, I want to come back and talk a little bit about some of the points that you were making about the administration here and maybe what some of the underlying root causes here. So, according to the Center for Disease Control, Black, gay, and bisexual men are more affected by HIV and AIDS than any other group in the United States. You know, some of the stats that you were mentioning earlier about the most disproportionately impacted communities here. So, what are some of the problems that the administration is creating for the communities that you work with the most? And to what extent do we think this might be caused by Trump and President Trump and Vice President Pence's homophobia and racism? I mean, I think we can't take this without context of some of this. There's something else going on here, and I don't think that we can afford to ignore it as like a movement.
Yeah, I mean, what I think is happening is that he is looking for an opportunity to do something for, or to feel like and to say that, you know, he's doing something for Black and Brown people, you know, as we come into 2020. That's my personal probably thoughts around what we're doing or what's happening. I think that that's probably a really big piece of it. But I mean, I think that you can even look at, I also think that there is probably a focus on how to engage folks in rural parts of the country. Within the 7 states that are part of the plan, a lot of those states are states that are having an opioid crisis.
Right.
And when, you know, who that looks like and trying to kind of get some political clout in those spaces. And, you know, I think that it's interesting, though, that you'll see in the strategy there's not much talk about race, you know, that there is a lot of kind of clouding and covering and not being explicit about what it really is, right? When you look at these 48 jurisdictions in 7 states, they are majority Black, they're majority Brown, they're people of color, they're poor people, but that's not the actual language that's being used. And so, you know, I think that there is a desire to gain some political will and capital. I think they're probably a bit surprised that it's, no, I don't know. I don't think they should be very surprised, but I think that folks that are in the administration are surprised that it hasn't kind of been welcomed with more open arms. But, you know, I think that speaks to, you know, we aren't going to forget, you know, people doing the right thing is not, that is the baseline, right? And when you don't do the right thing and explicitly do the wrong thing, and then not just do the wrong thing, but, you know, you put in policies that dehumanize folks, mm-hmm. that make people unsafe, that put people in cages, that put up walls and borders where there shouldn't be, that, you know, you have to question where the genuineness is.
Yeah, there's some hypocrisy here, right? Like,
oh, I mean, you know, to ban trans people from the military, to not expand Medicaid, but then to put all this money into HIV programming is, you know, it's not quite enough.
It's not quite enough. It doesn't make up for, you know, the myriad of other things, I would say.
Yeah. I mean, and the idea that I would hope people would be smart enough to know, the administration would be smart enough to know that you can't buy us off of this. Like, this is not it. This is not, you know, doing the right thing, listening to the science, long term. I mean, you know, there's huge cost savings as well. You know, doing the right thing is not, you know, going to get you a high five.
So, Rania, we've got about 3 minutes left in the segment, and I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the organization you work for, the Black AIDS Institute, and ask you how y'all are advancing solutions in the space that you guys work in.
Yeah, so the Black AIDS Institute was founded in May of 1999, and we are the only national HIV and AIDS think tank focused exclusively on Black people. Our mission is to end the AIDS epidemic by engaging Black institutions and individuals to confront HIV and AIDS. So we do training capacity building, we do information dissemination, mobilization, mm-hmm. advocacy, policy, and provide direct HIV services in Los Angeles, all from a uniquely and unapologetically Black point of view. Our model really speaks to our mission, which is our people, our problem, our solution. And there's really kind of 2 big things that we're currently focusing on when it comes to ending the HIV epidemic in Black America. The first one is making sure that Black Americans know about the tools to end HIV. You know, many people, particularly Black folks, don't know about PrEP. They don't know about pre-exposure prophylaxis. It's estimated that there's 500,000 Black people that are amazing candidates for PrEP. There's only 7,000 Black people on PrEP right now across the country. So there's this huge gap in making sure that people understand this and know about these tools, making sure that people understand the concept of U equals U, so undetectable equals untransmittable. People who are living with HIV can live long, healthy lives and don't have to worry about a fear of transmitting HIV to other people. So that's kind of one area where we do, you know, media campaigns, training, essentially trying to make sure that Black folks know about this. And then the second one is making sure that healthcare organizations, community-based organizations, know how to serve Black people. You know, we have to ensure that clinicians are culturally not just competent, but really humble in how they serve Black people. We have to make sure that Black people have healthcare access. We know that healthcare is one of the number one prevention tools for HIV. And so, you know, making sure that we have healthcare access, really pushing in states that are looking at expanding Medicaid to really support that effort. And then making sure that, you know, particularly for primary care physicians, that they know how to talk about HIV, that they're testing people and doing it in a way that speaks to the humanity and the brilliance of Black people as well.
So, Rania, we've got about 30 seconds until the end of the show, and I want to make sure people know where to find you. Where can they find you online, on Twitter, and what website should they check out?
Yeah, so please go to our website, www.blackaid.org. We have amazing resource tools there. So we have printed material. You can go on there to find a clinic near you or find a place to go get tested. You can follow us on all of our social media handles at blackaids.org. We're currently running some programming highlighting some amazing Black women, cis and trans women, women who are living with HIV and women who are not living with HIV, who are doing amazing work across the country to really have new conversations about HIV within communities.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Rania. Thank you for joining us. That was Rania Copeland, the president and CEO of the Black AIDS Institute. I'm Charlotte Hancock, and we've got my co-host here,
Brent Cohen.
And we'll be right back after this for the news. Thanks for joining. Welcome back to the Generation Progress Takeover of the Leslie Marshall Show. We now have Ellen Ratner, Bureau Media Chief for Talk Media News, and she's going to tell us the news of the day. Ellen, I heard that there's some stuff going on the Hill with the GOP Senate set to change the rules for approving Trump's appointments.
They want to change the appointment rules. Now, this would not be for Supreme Court nominees or appellate court judges or for members of the cabinet. However, there would be at least they want to increase the, or actually decrease, sorry, the amount of time that there would be debate. And they, you know, the problem is that the Democrats changed the rules so that you only needed a simple majority. You didn't need the 60 votes necessary to see the passage. Well, this is coming home to roost. But now they want to increase the roost, and they want to limit the debate. So that is happening.
So who is it that the Dems want for their nominee? There's some polling data that just came out on this.
Well, there is some polling data. That's correct. And this is the Morning Consult political poll. 54% of say they prefer a candidate who is an insider, compared with 29% who said they prefer a candidate who is an outsider. And it looks like Bernie Sanders is the highest scoring person, with, of course, Joe Biden, who has the second highest score, Kamala Harris of California, who's, by the way, having a big fundraiser in California tonight, Kristen Gillibrand of New York, Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, and Beto O'Rourke of Texas. That is in order, and the other people just don't even register. And it'd be very interesting to see what happens with that, for sure.
I saw that 35% of people said they wanted a nominee of color. Is that right?
Right. Well, my guess is that a lot of the people who are now running for president, I think you've got 16 once Joe Biden comes in, are actually people who are really running for vice president. That's what I think.
Gotcha. And then, Ellen, question about CVS. Disney has closed its $71 billion acquisition of Fox Entertainment.
They did that at 12:02 last night, so 12:02 Eastern time. And basically, this is for the film department. And then Fox News and sports and the business is going to run separately, and that is not part of the Disney deal at all.
Wow.
So it'll be very interesting to see what happens.
Wow. Well, thank you so much, Ellen, for joining us. This has been the Generation Progress Takeover of the Leslie Marshall Show, and we will see you all next week.